Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host in Hiroshima, joined by the amazing author Hiroko Yoda. Thank you so much for joining, Hiroko.
Thank you for having me. I mean, long time no see, long time no talk.
It is. I've had you and your partner, amazing Matt Ald, on the show talking about your wonderful books about demons and yokai and everything, all of the books. So you're no first-time writer, but this is a triumph. 8 million ways to happiness.
It's my first book, my solo. Yeah. So yes.
And it's very personal, right? As well. Like it's not like a guide to the 8 million gods. It's a real personal journey of your connection to Japanese culture and spirituality. Yes. And I think as someone who has lived in Japan for 30 years and more, this is just, it's so enlightening because there's so many things, even as a longtime resident of Japan, that I just don't really understand. Mm-hmm. And like you say in the book, there's so few people that actually feel comfortable talking about religion. It's not like a polite conversation usually. So yes, you've helped illuminate so many ideas.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that my book, The 8 Million Ways to Happiness, is a mixture of memoir and Japanese culture. Yes, I understand the format is memoir, but I wasn't planning to write a memoir at the first place. I wanted to write about Japanese culture, tradition, history. And that is why Matt and I wrote a trilogy of Yokai Attack, the Japanese Monster Survival Guide, followed by Ninja Attack and Yurei Attack, the Ghost Attack. Because those three things are closely associated with Japanese tradition and history and culture, as you know, because you live here for a long time. So it was a matter of time to write about kami, the spiritual beings. But I realized it's our culture. It's such a fabric of our life. So I had been struggling so hard how to explain people abroad who know nothing about my country. So that means in order to explain spirituality, I have to cover history. I have to cover, you know, in many places, because it's not one thing. So, you know, so sounds like travelogue someplace. And so my agent suggested me to write a memoir because it gives me a freedom to construct my, you know, the setting. And yeah, that's true. And then believe me or not, my story is very personal, but it's just nothing more than a tool for a reader. I'm just an avatar so that the reader can experience together with me and then learn how the Japanese, the average person, you know, the person in general, like me, non-religious person, to incorporate spirituality in daily life in a very positive way.
Yeah. But it's not like just because you're Japanese, this is the way it is. You talk about like doing the Shinto studies and deep research on all of these areas. And that's what really makes it so illustrative for people who are interested in Japan, who have these questions. And you had these questions too. So you were investigating, you were going out and finding the places, you were researching. It's really fascinating.
Yes. Okay, construction time. So yeah, we just talked about it. And so I'm sorry, I'm gonna talk loud. Anyway, yes, the thing is, it's interesting. You pointed out that many Japanese, feel uncomfortable, to talk about the religion. But it's not really uncomfortable. It just, Japanese people, including myself, cannot explain easily. Because Because the word religion, it's already in a wrong question to use to apply Japanese culture. That the word religion, English religion, in shugyo in Japanese, that term was only coined at the end of 19th century. Isn't that interesting? It blew my mind when I found out. Japan had been closed borders for hundreds of years. And then in 1853, the Commodore Perry led the Navy fleet came to Japan and negotiated Shogun to open up the borders. It was textbook example of the gumbo diplomacy, and Japan opened up the borders. And then Western concept flooded. It came in like constitution on banking, eating of beef and religion. So the Japanese created shugyo, the new term, as a translation of religion. So what religion, shugyo, means, it's basically Christianity, hierarchy. You can explain it probably better than that. You know, there's a hierarchy, there's a God, you know, a single God, G, capital G, God on the top, based on worship, based on faith, based on belief, which is totally different, the worldview. So before the talk, we're going to jump in. I'd like to talk about the big picture so that everybody can understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it doesn't sound too bad. Don't worry. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so there's an old concept called Yaoyorozu no Kami. Means 8 million spiritual beings. Kami means spiritual beings. In old times, Japanese people thought that everything surrounding them had spirit. The mountains, river, the ocean, sun, moon, even the words they spoke. And that worldview, it's pretty much active today. Not necessarily mean that Japanese believe that that everything has a spirit. No, but we feel the sense of it. And there are also the kami of plague, kami of poverty, and even kami of toothaches, those bad things. But not necessarily Japanese people believe that they all venerated those bad things. No, but it's a quiet reminder that those bad things do exist. So we have to deal with it. So in our worldview, is that spiritual beings are equal in existence, which is totally different from the Christian, Judeo-Christian worldview. So that is why survey after survey, when the Westerners ask Japanese people if you are religious, or do you believe in, what kind of, which religion do you believe in? Or, do you think religion is important in your life? And vast majority of people would answer no, because we have a just totally different worldview. But if you ask, do you think spirituality is important in your life? Probably, I would say yes. A lot of people probably would say yes. So that's the difference.
I think so. And like you talk about how most Japanese people and Japanese history of religion and spirituality is such a beautiful mixture of many things. So even the Japanese government trying to separate Shinto and Buddhism and Shugendo, those are the big three that you talk about, was so artificial because that wasn't the way most Japanese people were in the habit of practicing, right?
The Japanese people became secular on August 15th, 1945. And then so it's So that's the, you know, that was the one of the major turning point. But the thing is that, you know, there's so many, as you know, there's the temples in, okay, before that, there are three major belief systems in Japan: Shinto, Buddhism, and Shugendo. And then Shugendo is a hybrid of Shinto and Buddhism and another belief system like Taoism. Shinto is native in Japan. Buddhism is a foreign religion, came from all the way from India through China, and in came to Japan. We adapted it in the sixth century. And then the Shugendo just adapted everything. And then the practitioners of Shugendo are called Yamabushi. It's called the surrenders of mountains. So they practice centering around mountains. Anyway, the number of Shinto shrines and Buddhist and Shugendo temples is three times more than that of convenience store. And convenience, you know how ubiquitous convenience stores are in Japan. It's just basically, you know, you can find it every corner.
Yeah, everybody notices, right? When they visit Japan, they're right. Like, it's every corner. But
yes,
that's an amazing statistic.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Right? And most of them are open to public. Mm-hmm. Anybody can go in as long as they behave in a respectful manner. And respectful manner is a key. Because belief, it's not really important. I shouldn't say important, but it's not really the subject. What is more important, higher priority, is respect and sense of gratitude. Yeah. And then that, so it's to us that that those spiritual holy sites or the tradition, minimum the traditions are, you know, the closely tied to spirituality, because it helps us, evokes us, or lead us to the end, the feeling the gratitude for what we have, in a way, small or large.
Yeah, you talk about that concept of kuyo, right?
Yes.
Gratitude, but also remembrance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like to remember those who have been lost, but also to have a daily gratitude. And that's something everyone around the world is talking about, you know, showing gratitude as a way to be happy, right?
Yeah, the kuyo is it's another textbook example, I believe, that the Japanese people having hard time to explain what it is, because it's spiritual. It came kind of Buddhism religion, but at the same time, it's not really, you know, it's very close to the family things. That originally, I think, you know, I can say originally, based on the memorial, basically funerals. And then just remembering, you know, your family members in a way that you like. Traditionally, you know, we have tradition in kind of Buddhist, we do that Buddhist style of memorial, you know, the rituals, but it's not limited to that. And then to talk about, I wrote in the book, but you can, you know, to talk about them, you know, about fun memories, looking at pictures or eating the food that they, you know, they loved. That's not Japanese, you know? And then so it's easy. So I totally understand that people abroad, Westerners, you know, are interested in, you know, it's just very, you know, exciting to me. But I totally understand that they have a hard time grasp it. And then try to come up, call it ancestor worship. But it's not worship; it's your family. And then also the kuyo can, you know, apply to tools, because in our the world view of 8 million, the spirits even reside in tools. And because that I'm not talking about, you know, the ooh nonsense here, but because it's reminding us that tools we use, like for example, you know, the Zoom microphone, you know, earbuds, those are tools to helping us to communicate right now, and or food, you know, that those that vegetables or, you know, that beef or whatever meat or, you know, that it's just, we take their lives, you know, we take their lives to live. And so that's, it's another way, you know, it's a beautiful way to show, or beautiful tool for us to show gratitude to, again, what we have.
Yeah, I love that. And showing respect and even common decency amongst the public. This is something tourists often talk about when they visit Japan. Mm-hmm. Oh, we love Japan. Mm-hmm. Everybody is so kind, even to strangers. There's this common decency. Yeah. There's this respect, and that's such a beautiful part of the culture, for sure, that brings people back again and again. Mm-hmm. Now, I would love for you to read a little bit of your book.
Yes.
So I have this picture of you doing the audio recording.
Yes.
So you can also find Hiroko's wonderful audio recording of her book, if you would like to. But could you read the paragraph from page 269? Just talking about how all of the kami, all of the gods, are different. Just that one paragraph. Thanks.
Because each of the kami is different. Each plays a different role. Some are, to put in human terms, flashier than others. Some are avatars for things we would really rather avoid. There are, for instance, kami of plague, famine, and poverty. This doesn't mean we worship or praise them, but we can't reject them. No matter how much we fear these things or wish that we didn't have to deal with them, it is a fact that we do. And we must recognize that fact to deal with them in whatever human ways we can. That is what kami are all about. This is why 8 million isn't intended literally. It is poetic shorthand for the infinite. There's always room for more.
I love that. Thank you so much. Now, what was it like doing the audiobook? You talked about how it took about a week.
No. It took a month.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, because,
wow.
I mean, it was me who wrote the book. So yeah. I can't blame anybody.
And there's some powerful personal parts, right?
Yes.
So you talk about feeling emotional.
Yes.
But you had a helper to keep you from getting too sad, right?
Yes.
Right. Can you tell us about Gojo?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So at the very beginning, they suggested me to do the audiobook. And, but as you know, I'm not native. And I don't know if I can do this because my book is huge. So many words, 104,000 words or something like that. It's just, but then they told me that it's, you know, it's personal story. And my doing it is as will add value.
And people want to hear it in your voice, right?
Yeah. And, for sure. And then also I realized that my book contains a lot of Japanese words, and in some part I have to sing. My background is a localizer, and you know that I did a lot of the game localization, including recording. So I know how difficult to direct. So, and because my story is very personal, I'll do it. But there's another fear, I guess, the worry part. It's that it's so, my book says, you know, my title had contained the word happiness, but it's not about, you know, the about really the happiness, you know. I started from the rock bottom, the my mother's passing, which was a major blow in my life. So the older stories, I just didn't want to, you know, break down. And they told me to take my time, and which I did. But still, I had to work as a pro. I didn't have much, you know, time. There were people waiting for me to edit my thing. So yeah, I brought my little friend. Yeah, it's right here, Gojo. it's an anime, the Jujutsu Kaisen. If you want that thing, you know exactly what the character is. But anyway, he's looking at me whenever I felt, I just looked at him, and then, okay, I can do this. And yeah, I finished it. And now I have an audiobook.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. And for anyone, I've done some narration work. I know you've done recording before. It's not easy. You have to do a lot of takes. You have to repeat different parts.
Yes.
People are helping you. So sometimes you kind of lose the connection to the words. You have to do it again.
Yes.
People listening are like, can you do that part again? Or,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, luckily, so the engineer, producer, director, and my husband, you know, kept eyeing on 24/7, all the recording time. And then they caught me when I, you know, mispronounced the words and stuff. But the things I'm really very proud of is that I didn't have a retake. Normally you have retake. It's very, very normal.
That's amazing. Usually you have a lot of retakes. Yeah.
I waited for a while because they told me, it's like, we're going to contact you in a week, maybe a couple weeks. And I didn't. And then so I really checked, you know, that email with the maybe spam mail folders, you know, caught the things. And I didn't. So finally I said, what's going on? And I said, we don't have any retake. I said, what? So that's something I am very proud of.
Good for you. Very good. Another part I love, I mean, there's so many wonderful parts of your book, but the connections to mountains.
Ah, yes.
And you talk about how your grandfather was a mountaineer and you found his old diaries and you have this great connection. You often do hiking and things. Just so many wonderful connections to mountains, which I think is so appealing to visitors and people who love living in Japan. As well,
yeah. The Japan is, you know, really the 70% is okay. It's really crazy going on. Can you hear it? Just gosh. Anyway, Japan 70% of Japanese the land, it's mountains, because as you said, my great grandfather, which I mentioned in my book, he was a scientist. And an alpinist, that he actually one of the frontiers to adapt that Western concept of alpinism. So this is another thing that when Japan opened up the borders, and alpinism came in. It's basically the walk, you know, the climbing mountains for pleasure, because till then it was 100% spiritual. So I learned that, you know, in a Western concept, especially at the time period, alpinism, there's a lot of term that I feel uncomfortable or strange, even say conquering mountains, you know, seeing, attacking kind of thing. But because we have a history of spirituality, that we have, I think the Japanese, we have a very unique the mindset toward a mountain. Yes, this photo I took the mountain. This is actually top of the mountain, the Tateyama, and there's a Shinto shrine, and it's not new. It's there all the time, and I climbed there just because my great grandfather climbed too, and he had to hire a guide, because at the time period there's no map. There were maps, but it's not really covering mountains, because mountains are basically just look at it and then, you know, and then praise them. And then, you know, if you want to climb, you have a spiritual guide, and then you climb on a just certain path, and that was it. And when you go there, when you went to this meeting place, and there is a place to stay, and then you started walking, and this is the praying area, this is the praying area, and it came back. There's no free anything, which is good, but that was a tradition. And so anyway, I climbed there to just talk, think about my great-grandfather. So it's just one example. Mm. The spiritual things, holy sites, is just everywhere.
And then that, you talk about the Shugendo and the mountain monks, the Yamabushi, going up into the mountains. And you had this amazing experience when you went and saw them replace the twisted straw at the top of a sacred waterfall.
Yes.
That's a beautiful part of the book. Yes. Can you talk about that?
Yes. There are the ones you told me, the Shugendo and then the waterfall. That's a totally different thing, actually.
Sorry, but, I confuse them all the time.
Okay, can you repeat?
Sorry. Go ahead. So Shugendo, do you want to talk about Shugendo first and then the waterfall?
Yeah. Okay. The Shugendo. So the Shugendo is again one of the major belief systems in Japan. The practitioners are called the Yamabushi. The surrenders of mountains. They practice. Yeah. So it's interesting. See, if you want to learn about Shugendo, please read the book about, you know, there's a lot of religious books out there. So please read. I can talk about is how layperson like me adapt, you know, the Shugendo in my life. So yeah, the photo that you just showed, that's from my book. And I had the 20,000 photos or something, okay, in my life, and I have to say that photo is my favorite, because I took a photo at the Shugendo Temple in Nara, and then there was a ceremony, cherry blossom the festival ritual, and the Shugendo practitioners, the monks, and you know the they were parading to the temple for the ritual. And then I took the shot on their way to the prayer hall, the temple. And then just all of the sun, the reasons and why you see an Oni, the creatures, like, you know, the monsters, like, yeah. Okay, there's only one, but there's two, there's a pair. Because the founder of Shugendo and the Ozune and the aesthetic had a pair of Oni creatures, and they took care of a lot of errands. For the details, please read the book. But anyway, so that is why the two of them in a parade, you know, dressed up like the Oni creatures. So if one Oni, all of the sons stop and ask, you know, the woman, she is one of the tourists. See the woman wearing a mask, ask her, what's wrong with you? Why are you wearing a mask? That was a pre-COVID time. And then she said, well, I have a hay fever. And then he goes, okay, I am going to try to, you know, to try to get rid of your hay fever. And then he just basically kind of a symbolic figure, you know, he just took the bar and go, and he just basically symbolizing the whacking or whatever that, you know, that he's doing to get rid of the hay fever. And so of course, I mean, hay fever, well, you're not gonna just, you know, you can get rid of it with the bar, you know, the board or whatever, but it's symbolizing, it's telling us that in our spiritual world, in a worldview, you can find helpers even in the darkness, from even monsters. And so that is, you know, that was my takeaway. And that is why another Yama was a female. She's just laughing, you know, just because they're supposed to walk, but they're like, what are you doing kind of thing. But still, it's just very nice. It's just so close to, you know, even though the Shigendo is a belief system, but, you know, they are very approachable, you know, and that photo is very symbolizes. It's, you know, it symbolizes that.
You talk about the amazing feats that the Shugendo have to overcome, standing in waterfalls, walking over fire, walking over swords, and boiling water. Like, they're the tough, like, super challengers, also meditating in the cold mountains, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so when I read a lot of books about Shugendo, the stuff that you mentioned, it was very old times. I mean, you can see fire walking today, but many of the stuff is just basically just kind of really old stuff. But when I read it, yeah, that's current. You can see that. Anyway, but why are they doing that? And but it's and then I realized it's just another tool for them to appreciate or to evoke their some kind of a sense of gratitude or overcoming, you know, whatever that they have, you know, problems, or try to, you know, or try to help other people or help from nature. I don't know, but it's just a tool. So I know that, yes, the here's a Shigendo, the practitioner, he did 1,000-day the pilgrimage, I mean the mountain, you know, the pilgrimage, and it's the details in my book, but it's just a crazy, you know, ultra person. But he said, I didn't quote that in my book, but in his memoir, he said that he didn't do it for himself. Because that if he satisfied, you know, to achieve what he did, it didn't mean anything to anybody, including himself. And he said it's actually the life outside of a mountain is harder than the training he went through, which is what. But that was his nutshell. So my takeaway was that was, you know, the 1,000-day training for him was a tool to realize that the life outside of, you know, the mountains is actually harder. And so he said, but still, that, you know, he overcome something amazing. So he had to use whatever he learned. And then, you know, give his hands to a people because he's running a temple, you know, as a monk. So yes, so it's a very interesting, and it's very positive, which I really love, because it's everything is perspective. That, you know, that you can, you know, there is a things that you have to deal with. You can work on it with a frowning face. Or you can face it with, you know, kind of, okay, you know, just bring it on, you know, kind of positive mindset. You can do that too. It's perspective. And then that's what I learned from the Shigendo.
And you talk about how a lot of different religious people will practice Shugendo, or Shugendo is a real mixing. So when they had that rule that you had to separate the religions, Shugendo basically got erased. It wasn't possible to practice Shugendo without connection to Shinto or Buddhism, because it was all kind of interconnected. Is that right?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, you have to ask Jorge to get the practitioners. but my impression is just basically Japanese spirituality is radically inclusive. And that's not just a Shugendo, because once again, it's 8 million. 8 million concept, 8 million spiritual beings. So the Shinto is the same. There's always room for more. Always room for more. And then the Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, okay. I can't talk about other things. But Japanese Buddhism is the same. It's very inclusive. And so in my country, the belief systems peacefully coexist. I have to say, but still there is a clear separation between church and state here. Clear. But they peacefully exist. So it's easy to find temples and the Buddhist temple and Shinto shrine side by side. Or it's easy to find, you find Shinto shrine on the property of Buddhist temple. Or the Shinto shrine and the venerating Shinto shrines venerated Buddhist deities, vice versa, or both. Or you may find all kinds of deities on the property of Shigendo temple. And so it's very blurred, very, very blurred. And also the borders between those belief systems and us are very blurred too. And the one other example is that my last chapter of my book, The Prayer and Play, the playfulness is a key characteristics of our spirituality too. In the West, it's just maybe the playfulness in the religion's term, maybe it's just, sounds like, but it's to us, it's a major characteristic. And I give you, yeah, that's right. This is a good example. It's a Hello Kitty cosplaying a Buddha. It's like, okay, what's going on? But this is just a small example. You can find, the things like that, because it makes you smile. Like, what's going on? But the I found that, the Hello Kitty Buddha, in Kamakura, one of the forest spot near Kanagawa Prefecture, near Tokyo. Anyway, so it's interesting thing is that there's a shopping street. I found the Hello Kitty, the Buddha, at the toy store on the shopping street, starting with Shinto Torii Gate. The two pillars and the two pillars and two bars on the top. Yeah, like that. And that's a Shinto shrine gate. The reasons and why the shopping street started with the Torii Gate is just because the street leads to the Shinto shrine, Tsurugaoka Hachimangu. But I found a Hello Kitty Buddha. Okay? So it's just right there. The reasons and why there's a Hello Kitty Buddha on the Shinto shrines, the shopping street, is that because the Kamakura is known for two holy spots as a tourist spot. And then one is Tsurugaoka Hachimangu, which I'm talking about here. And also there's a Kotokin. It's a Buddha, the Buddhist temple. And so the borders between belief systems are blurred, and in prayer and playfulness, it's intertwined, because it makes a smile. And so it's very interesting.
That is interesting, because I always think of Shinto as the more strict, rigid one. But like when you did go to the top of the sacred waterfall and you talk with the priest, and you asked him, what do you like about Shinto? He said, flexibility.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, Japanese people, including myself, have such a hard time explaining hospitality. I mean, that's why, I mean, in order to explain the details, you need this big list. Okay. But when I interviewed a Shinto priest on the top of the Nachi Hall to see their the ceremony, the ritual, he told me, I asked him what kami means to him. And he said, they are a space in our mind, in your mind. And if it is you fill the blank. And then he said, and I love the concept of 8 million kami, yaoyorozu no kami, 8 million spiritual beings, because you can choose. There's infinite number of things that you can choose. Maybe one, maybe multiple, but you can choose to feel or show appreciation, and you feel that blank. So, you know, in the West, not to own something, emptiness, tends to be negative. That's how I learned living in America. But to us, it's not, you know, there's space, nothingness. It's not necessarily a bad thing, because you can fill it in, whatever you like. And that's a powerful thing. So I, including myself, Japanese people, because kind of explained what it is, we tend to downplay it. And then I thought that was a weakness. But it's not. I'm not talking about the Japanese spirituality, it's bitter or anything like that. No, not like that. Or convert or whatever. No. But it's a different perspective. And then I wanted to share, it's to share how we incorporate our spiritual view into our daily life and to live. And it really helps, especially in hard times, like myself, my mother's passing, and then later my father's. And it still hurts me. Still, I mean, that pain, I'm gonna take it to my grave. But yeah, then Kuyo, you know, whenever I feel miss them, I talk about them. With my sister, with my husband, and that's something that's not religion, but that's spirituality. And so when I learned the term secular, as a foreign language, that's a useful term. I was, what, 20 years old something? I needed to grasp it. I wrote it in the book, but yeah. Japanese are secular. Japan is secular because we don't go to, we don't have a Sunday school, like that. So it's easy, but still, later, soon I realized that the term secular didn't grasp our culture at all.
It's so important to understand it yourself, and then to the way that you're talking about your personal experience, but what you learned, how you understand it yourself, I think really helps the readers understand it more deeply in a real way, not just a philosophical way, right? But in a personal way. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about this book, really.
Thank you. Yeah, so, and then once again, you're free. If you don't take any of it, that is fine. Because once again, it's an 8 million concept. Not to take anything, it's one other way. But if
now, you tried so many, you studied for the Shinto exam, you tried Shugendo mountain monk training a little bit. You also did Miko. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. Yeah. I have to say I was very unique individual, because the people who learn, okay, before that, before that. I was Miko. I was a Shinto shrine dancer. But the people in the woman who learn how, you know, the Shinto shrine dances are usually associated with the Shinto shrines, or students from like Kokugaku University who major in Shinto kind of thing. And I was just curious. And then also I thought, you know, being Miko, you have to be young. I mean, if you go to Shinto shrine, you know how, you know, young those, you know, the shrine maidens are, because their job, and some of them are a part-time job, whatever. But one day I found that learning to Shinto shrine dance wasn't necessarily just an age thing. And it's like, oh, okay, but is it? But the sensei, unfortunately, she passed away, but 70, yes, the sensei at the 70s at the time, she was very nice of her to take me in her class and then taught me the Shinto shrine dance. But what I learned from that, I wrote in the book that it's not just dance. The photos that you showed me was a year after that I started learning. I mean, zero. And then the photo was taken. That was my first Shinto dance shrine as an offering to Kami all by myself. And I had to go through my mental, almost like a breakdown, because it's a nerve-wracking thing. But then I learned so many things. And for the details, please read my book.
I love that. And you also mentioned in the book how you saw in the very early morning a woman dancing flamenco,
yes,
in front of the guts, that dance can be a way to, mm-hmm, kind of connect or communicate with the guts.
Yeah. Yeah. So another thing I learned is that, play is, you know, is a key, because in the old legends, the Kojiki, the ancient record, Kojiki, written in the 8th century, in the Nihon Shoki, that entertaining Kami, there's a lot of stories entertaining Kami with dancing, music, and, you know, offerings kind of thing. So it's a play. It's a key. It's a key.
Now, kind of that beautiful kimono you wore as Miko, but the idea of wearing kimono is also a very personal part of your story, your relationship with your mom, and then years later, learning how to dress kimono was a big part. Tell us a little bit about that. That's such a powerful part of the story.
Yeah, that I learned how to wear kimono 5 years ago, at the beginning of COVID time. And it just because I wanted to wear kimono in a traditional way. That means there are a lot of rules to follow. And fortunately, there are many classes offering public. And so I went to one of them and then spent 3 years to learn all kinds of stuff, history, tradition, rules, how to wear kimono and how to put others wearing kimono kind of thing. And the picture that you're showing me was sort of kind of graduation, exam, sort of, for the graduation. And this type of the kimono is called furisode. And it's a special kimono, long sleeves. That's a major character, you know, the character. It's for that age, coming of age day So that the, for the girls who turn into adulthood, 20 years old, wearing that kimono for celebration. So that basically in almost entire year to learn how to put that beautiful furisode, the kimono. Of course, we have to use a torso because of the COVID time, but we learn it. And so the thing is, like, that experience opened up my past many, many years ago. I was only, 19 years old. But I was hurt with the furisode, with kimono. And because I was so hurt, I put it away and I forgot about it. And then beautiful kimono opened up my box. And my chapter was, it was dealing with, especially with anger. And then my takeaway is that the anger is not going to disappear, just like concept of 8 million spiritual beings. It's there. And it's there, and I have to deal with it. It's everything is equal in existence. The kimono, that chapter, it's very, very personal, because that's something that I didn't expect when I, to be honest with you, I didn't include it for my proposal when I sell my proposal to the publisher. It wasn't included. So,
It's about growth. It's about change and accepting the past. And you had cut yourself off from the idea of wearing kimono. And you said, I guess kimono just doesn't suit me, and kind of accepted that. But you changed. Yeah. You opened yourself up to it. You opened up your experience and learning and becoming an expert, and then winning the prize for the OB design for your graduation.
I didn't wear furisode, and unlike anybody else, it just for, a lot of reasons. But I was hurt, which I completely forgot. And I even thought I would look ugly in kimono. With something I didn't remember.
You definitely do not. You look beautiful in kimono. It's the thumbnail for the talk. We just have about 7 minutes left.
Yes.
I think one of the main themes of the book is all about how spirituality in Japan is everywhere. So let's talk a little bit more about these pictures that you shared with me. So we talked about Hello Kitty Buddha.
Yes.
And then the next one, is that Kamakura? Where is that?
Yeah, that's a Hakone.
Hakone.
Yeah, but it's you can find it on the lake.
I love that. Yeah, beautiful connection in the forest. Yes. And then you see the Torii Gate in the water beyond. Gorgeous.
Yeah, so it's interesting thing is that when you see Shinto Shrine Gate, it's just a tool. It's an icon. And then you feel the blank, because it reminds you it's worthy to respect. And it's just a reminder, because it's just a thing. Yeah, I gave that to you. Just Japanese spirituality is everywhere, if you know how to look. And even in entertainment, like Godzilla Minus One poster. And there's a Shinto Shrine Gate behind Godzilla. So I was excited. It's like, but this is very Japan. And I found it's very amusing.
That's awesome. And then this is a Shinto gate between two buildings.
Yeah, there's a Shinto shrine.
Tiny Shinto shrine.
Yes, the Shinto shrine. And it's embedded into the high buildings, apartments. And this the picture taken in Tokyo. But you can find that too. It's just everywhere. And you think Tokyo is, cosmopolitan, very modern, secular, a city kind of thing. And which is true, but at the same time, it's not that true, because spirituality peacefully coexist with the secular society. And that is a perfect example. And it's, in the past, there's a Shinto shrine there. And then, of course, things change. They have to construct apartments. Instead of demolishing it or moving it, people decided to keep it. It's amazing, but it's very nice.
So there's also a great section of your book talking about the superstitions of moving a shrine or a famous head. Yes. And how it caused havoc for the financial crisis.
Yes.
As well as businesses. And so they put it back. So read the book and find that story. That's
yes,
amazing.
Yes, please. Yes, please.
And then this?
Yeah, so this is another one, the top of the mountain. So you can find, the spirituality on the ground, say lake. You can find in the top of the mountain. This is a 3,000 meter high top of the mountains. There's a Shinto shrine, on the left. This is a kind of closer up. But this is only one example. Almost all mountains, and you can find that kind of the spiritual icons. It's
and everywhere. Then this on the side of the road.
That's at the Jizo Bodhisattva statues on the side of the street. And I took this picture in northern in Aomori Prefecture. So the interesting thing that I have to say is that I mentioned the number of Shinto shrine and temples. It's three times than that of the convenience stores. Those are only registered ones. The ones the Jizo statues, the ones that I showed you. That wasn't included. So it's just everywhere. So it's, once again, to go back to the very beginning of the conversation. If you ask Japanese people, are you religious? Do you believe in religion? Answer is like, no. Oh, no. But that's something wrong, because spirituality is everywhere, even Godzilla Minus One poster. So it's a fabric of our life.
Absolutely. And your book gives us so many great insights on that based on your personal research, your personal stories. So I would really recommend people pick up a copy. Now, this is the American and Japan copy, and the UK cover is a little different.
Yes.
8 million ways to happiness. It's not a how-to book specifically. It's a memoir, Japanese spirituality and Japanese culture all mixed together. It's a great insight for people like me who've lived in Japan for a long time, Japanophiles, but also it's a wonderful reference for people thinking about visiting Japan, thinking about gaining some insights about this very popular destination right now, right?
Yes. Yeah. If you learn something from my book, because that was the whole point of my book. I wanted to, kind of educational in a broad term. And that was my, so if you learn something about my culture, that would be golden.
And then also you have so many updated, wonderful reports and articles on your blog.
Yes, I do a newsletter.
Newsletter,
blog,
yeah.
@hirokoyoda.com. Mm-hmm. So just please feel free and say hello.
Yeah, we'll definitely put the links below. And then on your Substack, we can see your beautiful photography more. That's something I missed. I know you're a great photographer, and I wish there were more pictures in the book. So if you look at your website and look at your Substack, you can enjoy your beautiful photography as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Hiroko.
Thank you so much. I wish digital construction outside. It's just so crazy. It's just very enjoyable. And then thank you for having me.
Of course. Of course. It's wonderful. Really, congratulations on the book. I'm so glad to hear that it's so well received around the world. You mentioned there's also a copy translated into Spanish. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I put it somewhere. My books will be translated 8 other languages.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's Spanish is one, Portuguese, Romanian, Turkish, which is the first time in Islamic world for me. It's exciting.
How about Japanese?
Japanese, not right now. Yeah, if there is a re-offer, I would think about it. But right now, it's just outside Japan.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing and really well done. Thank you so much. Thanks, Hiroko.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone, for joining. And we'll put all the links below. And if you are watching on replay, add your questions and comments, and me and Hiroko will definitely answer.